This is VOA News via remote. I'm Lee Elga. Thousands arrested after mass protests in Russia. And now Russian police have arrested more than 4,000 people as supporters of the jailed Kremlin opposition leader Alexei Navalny demand his release from jail. AP correspondent Sarah Bassett reports.
Russian authorities had mounted a massive effort to suppress demonstrations after tens of thousands rallied across the country last weekend. Yet despite threats of jail, online warnings and tight police cordons, the protests again engulfed many cities. Anti-corruption investigator Navalny is Putin's best-known critic. He was arrested earlier this month after returning from Germany, where he spent 5 months recovering from a nerve agent poisoning that he blames on the Kremlin. Russian authorities have denied this. The United States has urged Russia to release Navalny and criticize the crackdown on protests. I'm Sasset.
A huge explosion happened near a popular hotel in the Somali capital Mogadishu Sunday, which say the car bomb was near Hotel Afrique, located in the vicinity of a busy security checkpoint en route to the Mogadishu airport. Militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility. Police say Al-Shabaab members stormed the hotel, but that most of the people inside were rescued, including Somalia's former state minister for defense. VOA reporter Abdikafi Yusuf Aden was also inside the hotel at the time and survived. Aden said people ran for their lives and hid. He also said he saw at least three people injured. A World Health Organization-led team of experts investigating the origins of the coronavirus visited the wet market at the center of the pandemic Sunday. This is VOA News. A car bomb exploded in northern Aleppo, leaving at least five people dead and more than 25 injured, according to Syria's Al-Watan newspaper Sunday. State news agency Sana reported the bombing in the city of Azaz, but did not say how many people had been killed or injured. Turkey, which is allied with some rebel groups opposed to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, is in control of the area where the explosion happened. A separate suicide car bombing at a checkpoint manned by the Turkish-backed Free Syrian Army in the Bazaa area, also in northern Aleppo, killed six FSA members and injured four, according to FSA sources. With a little more than a week to go before former President Donald Trump's second impeachment trial, there's a major shakeup on his defense team. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Two people familiar with the situation tell the Associated Press the defections include Trump's two lead impeachment lawyers and two former federal prosecutors from South Carolina. The reason? A difference of opinion on what the defense should be. One person tells AP Trump wants to repeat the same allegations of election fraud that have been refuted by election officials of both parties and his own Justice Department, but that he used to stir up a crowd of supporters on January 6th, who then marched to the Capitol and stormed it. Other Republicans have made a simpler case, questioning the constitutionality of the impeachment because he's no longer in office. Trump's set to stand trial in the Senate the week of February 8th. Ben Thomas, Washington.
An Israeli official said Sunday the nation could begin overcoming the COVID-19 crisis after fully vaccinating a third of its population. Launching what has become the world's fastest vaccine rollout on December 19th, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu set protecting Israel's most vulnerable residents as the benchmark for a possible reopening of the economy in February. But a projected mid-January turnaround in curbing the spread of the illness did not happen. Despite a third national lockdown, cases and deaths have surged among the part of the population that has not yet been vaccinated. Officials blame this on the highly contagious foreign variants of the coronavirus. Italian politician Matteo Renzi said he would like to see the former European Central Bank chief Mario Draghi become prime minister. Reuters reports a party source spoke about Renzi, who triggered Italy's political crisis this month by pulling his Italia Viva party out of the ruling coalition. Via remote, I'm Liz Palka, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the threat from domestic extremism. Over the last several years, the FBI and leading terrorism experts have been saying that domestic extremism and white supremacy represent a rising danger in the United States that overshadows the threat from militant Islamist groups. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The storming of the U.S. Capitol on January 6 is the latest and most disturbing manifestation of the threat posed by homegrown terrorists. Among the thousands who descended on Washington at the urging of former President Donald Trump were adherents to the QAnon conspiracy theory, white supremacists, anti-Semites, and members of far-right anti-government militia groups like the Proud Boys, Three Percenters, and Oath Keepers. Despite the thoroughly discredited allegations of voter fraud, then-President Donald Trump encouraged his supporters to challenge his loss to Democrat Joe Biden. His role in stoking the assault on a joint session of Congress prompted the House of Representatives to impeach him for, quote, inciting insurrection. The domestic extremists who heeded Mr. Trump's call became further radicalized in online chat rooms, which propagated disinformation and conspiracies regarding the 2020 election results. What is more alarming to terrorism experts and analysts is that among the array of anti-government protesters in the violent mob were members of the military and police officers. Some analysts worry that white nationalists and anti-government sympathizers may be infiltrating the ranks of the U.S. military and police forces around the country. So what tools does U.S. law enforcement have to apprehend, charge, and punish domestic terrorists? Ali Soufan, a former FBI agent, says, quote, "It is time for Congress to act by strengthening domestic terrorism statutes so the nation's prosecutors can leverage similar tools and legislation that exist for combating international terrorism," unquote. And just this week, the Wall Street Journal reports that, quote, "The Department of Homeland Security issued a national terrorism alert warning that violent domestic extremists could attack in the coming weeks, emboldened by the January 6 riot at the U.S. Capitol," unquote. Well, for more on the threat of homegrown terrorism and what can be done to prevent and fight it, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Daryl Johnson is one of the foremost experts on domestic terrorism in the United States. Previously a senior analyst at the Department of Homeland Security, he is now the owner of DT Analytics. That's a private consulting firm for law enforcement, academia, and other organizations. He is also the author of the recently published book, Hateland, A Long, Hard Look at America's Extremist Heart. And Jason Blazekas. He's a former State Department counterterrorism official, currently the director of the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, California. He's also a senior fellow at the New York-based Soufan Center. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Great to be on the program, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Daryl Johnson, let me go to you first. Now, I'd rather not get into Mr. Trump's liability or even the woefully inadequate security at the Capitol on January 6th that allowed the mob of protesters to breach the Capitol. Rather, I'd like this discussion to revolve around what we're seeing, you know, a more brazen manifestation of this right-wing white nationalist anti-government domestic terrorism. We saw the attack on the Capitol. We've seen the attack on Michigan's governor, protests meant to subvert the democratic process. And of course, we've seen violent events previous to this, whether in Charlottesville, the Unite the Right rally, the massacre at Walmart in El Paso, the Tree of Life synagogue attack and so forth. But Daryl, my question to you, could you characterize this threat for us as you see it today?
So, Carol, what we're talking about on the far right are groups that are ultra-nationalistic. They wrap themselves in patriotism. We also have various hate groups that believe in the supremacy of the white race. So those are the two broad categories of extremist groups we have on the far right. What we've seen since 2009 is these groups have continued to grow and recruit and radicalize because of a number of factors. First, it was the unprecedented election of Barack Obama, the first African-American president back in 2008, coupled with an economic downturn. These created fertile grounds for people to recruit and radicalize right-wing extremists. We now fast forward to 2020. We've got a pandemic. These individuals on the far right, particularly the anti-government groups, do not like the government regulation. They don't like wearing masks. They don't like being told how many people should assemble in a group or to stay at home. So they look at these things as infringements on their constitutional rights, and it's provided fertile ground for more recruitment and radicalization. Couple that with the former president's continuous pandering of these groups on his Twitter accounts, encouraging them to liberate various states, to protest and to bring arms, and also agitating them with this notion of a rigged election and rampant voter fraud. So despite all of the evidence contrary from the courts, from Democrats, as well as fellow Republicans, there's still a segment of people in the United States that believe former President Trump, that this was a stolen election. And so we're going to continue to see these people agitated around that issue and radicalizing around it.
I'd like to turn now to Jason for your take. Anything to add or subtract to what Daryl just told us?
In terms of grievances, the anti-government groups in particular, their rise in the mid-1990s, I think, is an important learning point for us. The Ruby Ridge event in Idaho, where the Weaver family was surrounded by federal law enforcement and his wife was killed. The Waco, Texas cult led by David Koresh, the Branch Davidians, the situation in which federal law enforcement went in, and the result was a fire that led to the deaths of a number of the Davidians. The 1994 assault gun ban that the Clinton administration passed to limit the flow of assault weapons. These events, amongst others, led to a pronounced rise within the anti-government movement, culminating in the 1995 attack by Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City that killed more than 150 people in addition to small children. And that's when the federal government started taking events more seriously related to the anti-government groups as posing a threat to U.S. domestic interests. And I think we're at the same point today. That event, January 6th, the insurrection, the storming of the Capitol, to me was the equivalent, even though it didn't have the death toll, the symbolic equivalent of what Timothy McVeigh did in 1995. And it has, I think, energized law enforcement and the Biden administration to take the threat very seriously. And my concern moving forward is that this is an animated movement, but they're also going to be animated by the new administration and the policies the new Biden team will be adopting. They're certainly going to look at policy issues around gun control. They're going to become more involved in multilateralism. They're going to work within the context of the United Nations to counter terrorism and probably even to talk about the rise of the radical right throughout the world. And I think these policy issues that they're pursuing are going to be perceived by the anti-government groups like the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters, as being a form of tyranny where the United States is being usurped somehow by the United Nations. And this is a common argument amongst the radical right in the United States, not just in anti-government groups, but with the white supremacists and street movements like the Proud Boys. That, coupled with the fact that the Biden team is going to perhaps lift immigration restrictions, perhaps not pursue a border wall. Also, this issue of immigration is going to motivate individuals as well on the right. So these are the things I'm observing, Carol.
That's a very interesting observation, Jason. Let me turn back to Daryl to pick up on some of the points you made. Daryl, some analysts say that these domestic extremists have become radicalized in much the same way as members of Al-Qaeda and other foreign terrorist groups. In fact, Ali Soufan of the Soufan Center has said this. They've been fed a steady diet of disinformation, taught that somehow violence is justified to achieve political ends, and that, for example, the First Amendment prevents law enforcement from surveilling or investigating Americans based solely on their political views, even if their views are deemed racist or anti-government. The law says it's a crime to provide material support to specially designated foreign terrorist organizations, but it doesn't seem there's a parallel for domestic groups which harbor extreme positions. What do you say to that?
Well, Carol, we're all human beings, and I think there are commonalities in the radicalization and recruitment process into these extremist organizations. The only thing that differs is really the environment in which the people are operating, as well as their personal life experience. So there may be differences in how a white supremacist will be triggered to carry out an act of violence here in America versus somebody over in the Middle East joining ISIS. So there are some parallels, but there are some unique differences. And you mentioned how the extremists here in America do use their constitutional rights to kind of hide behind, and it does create some difficulties on the part of the intelligence community and law enforcement to collect and monitor these people. So we have to take those things into consideration when we're developing strategies to combat these groups in the future. But we can work with other organizations that don't have those same limitations and restrictions. Our private sector social media companies don't operate like the government does. They don't have intelligence oversight. They don't have these prohibitions against monitoring people for criminal activity before it happens. So we need to develop strategies that build these relationships between private sector entities, social media companies, civil rights organizations, even these groups that have organized that are called exit programs, such as Christian Piccolini's Free Radicals organization. The government can work hand in hand with these types of groups and kind of get around some of these issues so that we can start really monitoring this threat and bringing all strategies and tools to bear on this problem.
Jason Blazekas, how do you see this dilemma between how the United States is able to apprehend and charge foreign terrorists much more easily than with these domestic terrorists that we're seeing on the rise?
So post 9/11, the United States shifted its focus from pre-9/11 focus on ethno-nationalist foreign-based organizations like the various Palestinian groups that were on the State Department list of foreign terrorist organizations, groups like Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. The U.S. wasn't really focusing on the global Salafi jihadist threat posed by al-Qaeda. And then, of course, 9/11 happens, and then the United States pivots its array of intelligence collection systems against the Salafi jihadist threat. Then fast forward to 2014 and the rise of ISIS, and again, kind of demonstrating the power of the Salafi jihadist threat. Fast forward to where we are today, the United States, its intelligence collection across the board, both internationally and domestically, isn't really well postured to go after this particular threat posed by anti-government groups and white supremacists based at home. So one of the first things I think the Biden team will need to do is to think about intelligence collection priorities, both overseas and domestically. What can the FBI do in terms of pivoting resources to get better collection and infiltrate the various groups that we're concerned about, like the Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, the Proud Boys? What can we do about those overseas movements that some of these organizations have links to? Because they certainly are talking with one another. You see transnational overseas groups like the Russian Imperial Movement talking to people who organized the Unite the Right rally, like Matthew Heimbach years ago in 2017. These connections are real. So that's the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do is I certainly would evaluate the laws that we possess to see where we have gaps, because, of course, we have a definition of domestic terrorism. Both DHS has one and the FBI has one. The FBI is pursuant to 18 U.S.C., the United States Code. But there's only really one domestic terrorism charge we can pursue against individuals who carry out an attack on the homeland, and that's for the use of a weapon of mass destruction to include other kinds of incendiary devices that aren't chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear in orientation. People like Robert Bowers, who carried out the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting, he wasn't charged for an act of domestic terrorism because he used a handgun. So perhaps it's worth exploring, Congress debating the pros and cons of amending the laws to see whether or not we can actually charge individuals who carry out violent activity. And I think that's really important, that that activity has to be violent in orientation, with acts of domestic terrorism if they meet the definition that we have for domestic terrorism. It's really strange to me, Carol, that we have a definition of domestic terrorism, but we don't have a lot of charges that we can levy against individuals who are carrying out premeditated political acts of violence that lead to the deaths of individual civilians, all with an eye towards creating an atmosphere of fear. And I think we are living that environment of fear right now. And I think it is time to at least explore this, because certainly I think it is the case that some of these groups are hiding behind the First and Second Amendment protections. But the last thing I'll say is we need to be really careful as we evaluate the need for new laws to ensure that we don't overreach, that we don't further the grievances of these groups than their perceived view of the United States as being a tyrannical entity. Because there is that possibility that if we go too far, we could become a police state. And that's the last thing we need, Carol.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are Daryl Johnson, a leading expert on domestic terrorism and former senior analyst at the Department of Homeland Security, and Jason Blazekas, from whom you just heard. He is director of the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. We're discussing the insidious threat from domestic terrorism in the aftermath of the January 6th deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. Well, here's a shout out to a faithful radio and social media fan from the DRC, Alphonse Nkongolu. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our program and back to you, Daryl Johnson. You both alluded to the role of social media because we're seeing the spread of disinformation, conspiracy theories in these online chat rooms. You know, we can't necessarily control the role of politicians like former President Trump or even Rudy Giuliani and others. But what about the role of social media? What is the best way to debunk these noxious conspiracy theories that are circulating and that people are consuming and somehow believing?
It's a daunting task because there's so much of it in this day and age of the internet. So I think it's incumbent upon the social media companies to develop policies and whatever type of enforcement that they want to take against people that are spreading these types of conspiracy theories. These things are at the root of motivation and radicalization. Disinformation, the conspiracy theories, these are the things that motivate people to violence. And I think we need to hold people accountable for creating these types of things, whether it's through a civil matter or through ostracizing them or having some sort of counter messaging platform that calls out these deliberate falsehoods. There are companies out there that police the internet and try to get to the root of these rumors and myths and conspiracy theories. Perhaps we can market these types of organizations for the research and work that they do to try to debunk these things. But it's incumbent upon, you know, every American to counter and refute these types of things when they hear it from a family member or a coworker or friend. And hopefully it'll have an impact on that person and get them to start thinking about how they could actually research themselves for the truthfulness of these things before accepting it as truth.
Jason Blazekas, Daryl Johnson makes some very good points. On the other hand, the echo chambers of these disinformation platforms are so intense. We're even seeing a right-wing media outlets like Newsmax or OANN traffic in outright misinformation. Many of these networks perpetuated what is now considered the, quote, big lie that somehow former President Trump really won the election. You know, how can we convince Americans of the objective truth? What are some measures that can be taken to debunk these conspiracy theories and falsehoods?
So that's a really difficult challenge that researchers are trying to answer. Part of the challenge, I think, stems from the fact that we have the death of local news. I remember growing up having a local newspaper that I could access, and my family read it, and it had verifiable facts. You had researchers and writers who actually put out stories that were based on factual information. Now we have an ecosystem in which you have news services that do bandy falsehoods. So what do you do about that? One thing I think, but it's going to take time, is that we invest early on at the elementary school level, the high school levels, in media and digital literacy. That in media literacy, understanding your sources. Where is this publication coming from? What is its bias? so that the reader understands that perhaps that source could be trying to manipulate them. But that has to start really early on in the classroom. The second thing is digital literacy. People are living online increasingly more. And in that sense, people need to understand who they are digitally. How are individuals or organizations trying to manipulate them online? The second solution, I think, is there needs to be some level of accountability for large social media companies like Twitter, Facebook, Google, and YouTube. They are certainly allowing for disinformation to spread on their platforms. This is how people get their news right now, unfortunately, on their Facebook groups. And this news is often falsehood. So one thing former President Trump has said time and again, that we need to look at Section 230 of the Communications and Decency Act. There are, I think, small changes that can be done to Section 230 that would allow for Congress to compel social media companies to do better. For instance, these companies use algorithms to recommend the next video to watch or to follow somebody new on Twitter. If these algorithms are continuing to essentially encourage people to go to hate-filled pages or look at hate-filled tweets, then there needs to be accountability. So I think Congress should look at thinking about how they can hold to account the companies that allow these algorithms to continue to make these bad recommendations that continue to fuel the fire surrounding the spread of disinformation.
In the few minutes we have left, back to you, Daryl Johnson. I wonder if you could enlighten us a bit about what is known as insider attacks. What do we know about the tendency of some white supremacists applying for military or police forces, you know, the infiltration of our very security forces that we count on to protect us, having in their ranks people we can't really fully trust who don't have our best interests at heart? What do you know about that?
The military has had a longstanding policy that prohibits active participation in white supremacist groups. I think that that policy is outdated, given the internet. People affiliate with these groups and radicalize and get indoctrinated online. They're not really active members of any type of a group, per se. There's also no prohibition in the military for joining three percenters or oath keepers or other anti-government extremists. So that policy seriously needs updating and expanded to capture the broad range of extremism that we're talking about here, because we do have an infiltration problem. Of the 150 people so far that have been arrested for the Capitol insurrection on various federal charges, 20% are members of the military, and we have approximately 30 police officers that were off duty at the time who are being investigated by the FBI for participating in this insurrection. So that just clearly shows you we do have a problem. And rather than looking at it from a criminal matter, we need to be looking at it from an administrative matter, whether these people are suited for their positions and whether they should be empowered with these law enforcement and military authorities.
Jason Blazekas, you get the last word on that.
It's a longstanding challenge. If you look at the major acts of domestic terrorism in the United States over time, at least in the 1990s, Timothy McVeigh, former military, carrying out the Oklahoma City bombing, then a series of bombings against abortion clinics, also former military. So this is a persistent challenge. And those stats that Daryl mentioned, aren't they startling? They really are. And it's a worry to me. So I agree with Daryl. This is an insider and intelligence threat challenge. In terms of where I would start thinking about devoting resources, Department of Defense has an office that's charged with looking at personnel security and suitability. And I think changing the way in which personnel are evaluated needs to be done very quickly. And I know members of Congress encourage the Department of Defense to have a paradigm shift in how they evaluate their personnel, perhaps new questions that maybe are more targeted and focused on trying to understand who's coming into the military. What are their social media accounts? What are their beliefs? Do any of those attune to at all white supremacist groups or street movements like the Proud Boys or anti-government groups? The Oath Keepers in particular, they make a concerted effort to recruit military and law enforcement. That's in their charter. And they are taking advantage of the U.S. training that we give our military and our law enforcement officials. The second thing I would do, practically speaking, is instead of buying these fancy tanks for wars we're no longer fighting, is investing perhaps more deeply in Air Force Office of Special Investigation. Those who are actually charged with investigating individuals for carrying out potential criminal activity, Those investments, I think, would go a long way in terms of trying to counter this internal challenge that we're facing in the United States today.
Gentlemen, for now, I'm afraid that's just about all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Daryl Johnson, owner of DT Analytics, and Jason Blazekas, director of the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Welcome to Learning English, a 30-minute broadcast from The Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower. We also use words and sentences made for English learners. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Today, Dan Friedel talks about vaccinations for those going to college or university. Then, Armin Kasabian tells us about Mardi Gras and how people are preparing for the holiday. I will return with this week's words and their stories. We will end our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, the education report.
People involved in higher education are asking, will universities require students to get the coronavirus vaccine before they come back to school? Many universities already request health information from new students. Most, especially those from the U.S., already receive vaccines as children. Schools like the University of Wisconsin, for example, do not require students to be vaccinated for many diseases, but strongly recommends them. Vaccines are recommended for diseases like hepatitis and measles. A form asks students to check with their doctors and make arrangements to get any missing immunizations before you come to campus. As the coronavirus vaccine becomes more available, students may someday be required to prove that they have received the coronavirus vaccine before coming to school. But public health experts say it is unlikely universities will be able to require it this fall. Rupali LeMay is a scientist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. She is an expert in vaccines and public health. She studies how people make decisions about vaccines. LeMay said it is likely universities will enter the 2021-2022 school year still using other methods to control the spread of the virus, even if some students and professors have received the vaccine. These methods include wearing a face covering, virus testing, social distancing, and keeping groups of students together in small groups. LeMay said the most likely situation this fall is that some students will be vaccinated, but most social distancing rules will remain in place. Universities, however, will probably urge students to take classes in person. LeMay said the coronavirus health crisis has made universities think hard about the best ways to teach students. While many schools have deployed distance learning in 2020 and 2021, The majority of them believe the best way to teach is in person. Most adults, she said, can effectively work from home, but for college students, an important part of the educational experience is the social interaction and cooperation that come on campus. So many universities want to find a way to reopen. Some people are hopeful that college campuses will be back to normal in September 2021 because vaccines are becoming more available. LeMay said that is closer to a dream than reality. That is because not enough people on college campuses will receive the vaccine by the start of the coming school year. Some older teachers and professors will have been vaccinated, but college-age students have not yet been prioritized by most public health organizations. For this reason, herd immunity may not be reachable 7 months from now. The term herd immunity describes a situation when enough people in a population are resistant to a disease that it cannot spread. International students are part of nearly every university community in the U.S. Will those students be required to be vaccinated before they return to campus? Both Busta and LeMay say it is an important question that has not yet been fully answered. LeMay said she values her international students at the Johns Hopkins University. We pride ourselves on a diverse student body, she said. Her concern is whether international students who are in 1 or 2 year graduate programs will get the experience they would like. She said she is looking forward to finding out more on rules for international students coming back. This will continue to be a bit of an evolving situation, she said. Busta said international students were already starting to consider universities in other countries before the coronavirus health crisis. Schools in places like Australia, Canada, and Britain are offering competition. In addition, some policies have made it harder for students from other countries to study in the U.S. The virus is definitely impacting students' ability to enter the country, but there are other factors at play as well, she said. I'm Dan Friedel.
Each year, the city of New Orleans, in the state of Louisiana, holds a celebration known as Mardi Gras. This year, traditional activities have been canceled because of the coronavirus health crisis. But many houses around the city are now preparing for the special week. The Mardi Gras celebration often involves a parade with people dressing in colorful clothes and special vehicles covered in decorations called floats. What is known as Carnival season begins in early January and ends in February. Mardi Gras is one of several carnival celebrations in traditionally Roman Catholic parts of the world. The celebrations are held the day before Catholics begin the religious observance of Lent. Even before the city announced its plans, some groups decided they would not be parading for the 2021 Mardi Gras. Safer choices include handing out gifts from a streetcar and organizing outdoor art and virtual parades. The House Float movement started in November, after a government official said the parade would be canceled. The term House Float describes homes decorated as if they were Mardi Gras floats. Megan Joy Boudreau lives in New Orleans. She started the Crew of House Floats group. She wrote on Twitter, "We're doing this. Turn your house into a float and throw all the beads from your attic at your neighbors walking by." Her tweet was meant as a joke. But the more she thought about it, the more she realized she liked the idea. When she created the Crew of House Floats, she thought only a few friends and family would join. But there are now 39 smaller groups to help plan for different areas in the city. "I didn't think I was starting a Mardi Gras crew. Here I am," Boudreau said. "I've got myself a second full-time job." January 6th was the official first day of carnival season, and the group already has more than 9,000 members. 3,000 of the members are from other states or countries. There is even an online map of people who are decorating their houses. Charlotte Charlie Jallins Daly is one of two map makers for the project. She said people as far away as England and Australia are showing their houses online. This year, the Mardi Gras celebration will be on February 16th. Houses are to be decorated at least 2 weeks before. The hope is that people will spread out widely and see the homes during different times. I'm Armin Kasabian.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. There are many ways to get people to do what you want. You can boss them around. Do this, do that. You can also threaten them. You had better do what I say or else. But these methods might not get the best results. And you probably will lose a few friends. Perhaps being nice to other people is the best and easiest way to get what you want. In fact, we have a saying that describes this way of thinking. You get more flies with honey than with vinegar. We should first thank bees for making something as sweet and tasty as honey. Vinegar can be tasty too, but on its own, it is sour and has a bitter taste. When you mix vinegar with other things, such as oil, it can taste much better. But on its own, vinegar is hard to swallow. So the expression, "you get more flies with honey than with vinegar," means it is a good idea to be nice to others. You can win over people more easily by being polite and kind. Being mean or unpleasant is like being full of vinegar. You will push more people away by acting sour or bitter. Nice, polite requests often work better. And in the end, you actually get what you want. Like many English expressions, you do not need to say the full sentence. Simply saying, you get more flies with honey, is good enough. Now let's hear how to use this idiom in a dialogue.
We are way behind on painting this house. If the volunteers don't speed up, we will be painting in the dark.
Correction. They will be painting in the dark. I will be at home watching television.
Be nice. After all, the volunteers aren't getting paid.
Well, that is the definition of a volunteer. But you're right. They should work faster. I'll yell at them some more.
Wait. You have been yelling at them?
Well, yeah.
I put you in charge of the volunteers, and you've been shouting at them? Have you lost your mind?
Who's the one yelling now? Anyway, it's the only way to get them to work hard.
No, it's not. You catch more flies with honey than with vinegar.
Well, that may be true, but yelling works too.
Not on my project. Now go apologize and help them paint. And do not be rude or mean.
Okay. Calm down. You don't have to yell or call me names. Didn't you ever hear you catch more flies with...
Don't you even finish that sentence.
And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. But join us again next week, when we will explore another idiom or expression in American English. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The early years of the 20th century were a time of movement for many black Americans. Traditionally, most blacks lived in the southeastern states. But in the 1920s, many blacks moved to cities in the north. Black Americans moved because living conditions were so poor in the rural areas of the Southeast. But many of them discovered that life was also hard in the colder northern cities. Jobs often were hard to find, housing was poor, and whites sometimes acted violently against them. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell about the life of black Americans in the 1920s and how they helped form traditions.
The years just before and after 1920 were difficult for blacks. It was a time of racial hatred. Many whites joined the Ku Klux Klan organization. The Klan often terrorized blacks. Klan members sometimes burned fiery crosses in front of the houses of black families, and they sometimes beat and murdered blacks. The Ku Klux Klan also acted against Roman Catholics, Jews, and foreigners, but it hated blacks most of all.
The United States also suffered a series of race riots in a number of cities during this period. White and black Americans fought each other in Omaha, Philadelphia, and other cities. The worst riot was in Chicago. A swimming incident started the violence. A black boy sailing a small boat entered a part of the beach used by white swimmers. Some white persons threw stones at the boy. He fell into the water and drowned. Black citizens heard about the incident and became extremely angry. Soon, black and white mobs were fighting each other in the streets. The violence lasted for 2 weeks. 38 persons died. More than 500 were wounded. The homes of hundreds of families were burned. The violence in Chicago and other cities did not stop black Americans from moving north or west. They felt that life had to be better than in the South.
Black Americans left the South because life was hard, economic chances few, and white hatred common. But many blacks arrived in other parts of the country only to learn that life was no easier. Some blacks wrote later that they had only traded the open racism of the rural Southeast for the more secret racism of northern cities. Blacks responded to these conditions in different ways. Some blacks followed the ideas of Booker T. Washington, the popular black leader of the early 1900s. Washington believed that blacks had to educate and prepare themselves to survive in American society. He helped form a number of training schools where blacks could learn skills for better jobs, and he urged blacks to establish businesses and improve themselves without causing trouble with whites. Other blacks liked the stronger ideas of William Du Bois. Du Bois felt that blacks had to take firm actions to protest murders and other illegal actions. He published a magazine and spoke actively for new laws and policies to protect black rights. Du Bois also helped form a group that later became the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The NAACP became one of the nation's leading black rights organizations in the 20th century.
Probably the most important leader for black Americans in the 1920s did not come from the United States. He was Marcus Garvey from the Caribbean island of Jamaica. Garvey moved to New York City in 1916. He quickly began organizing groups in black areas. His message was simple. He said blacks should not trust whites. Instead, they should be proud of being black and should help each other. Garvey urged blacks to leave the United States, move to Africa, and start their own nation. Marcus Garvey organized several plans to help blacks become economically independent of whites. His biggest effort was a shipping company to trade goods among black people all over the world. Many American blacks gave small amounts of money each week to help Garvey start the shipping company. However, the idea failed. Government officials arrested Garvey for collecting the money unlawfully. They sent him to prison in 1925. And 2 years later, President Coolidge ordered Garvey out of the country. Marcus Garvey's group was the first major black organization in the United States to gain active support from a large number of people. The organization failed, but it did show the anger and lack of hope that many blacks felt about their place in American society.
never may be my sugar. That's why my sugar is so...
Blacks also showed their feelings through writing, art, and music. The 1920s were one of the most imaginative periods in the history of American black art. Claude McKay, Langston Hughes, and County Cullen were three of the leading black poets during this time. McKay was best known for his poems of social protest. Hughes produced poems about black life that experts now say are among the greatest American poems ever written. Black writers also produced longer works. Among the leading black novelists were Jesse Fawcett, Gene Toomer, and Rudolph Fisher.
The 1920s also were an exciting time for black music. Black musicians playing the piano developed the ragtime style of music. Singers and musicians produced a sad, emotional style of playing that became known as the blues. And most importers began to play and enjoy a new style that was becoming known as jazz. Jazz advanced greatly as a true American kind of music in the 1920s. Musicians Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and UB Blake played in gathering places and small theaters. White musicians and music experts from universities came to listen. Soon, the music became popular among Americans of all kinds and around the world.
Blacks began to recognize in the 1920s their own deep roots in the United States. They began to see just how much black men and women already had done to help form American history and traditions. The person who did the most to help blacks understand this was black historian Carter G. Woodson. Woodson received his training at two leading universities, Harvard in Massachusetts and the Sorbonne in France. He launched a new publication, the Journal of Negro History, in which he and other experts wrote about black life and history. Historians today call Woodson the father of the scientific study of black history.
The 1920s also were a period in which a number of blacks experimented with new political ideas and parties. The difficult social conditions of the period led many blacks to search for new political solutions. Two leftist parties, the Socialists and the Communists, urged blacks to leave the traditional political system and work for more extreme change. Two leading black socialists, Chandler Owen and A. Philip Randolph, urged blacks to support socialist candidates. However, they gained little popular support from blacks. Communists also tried to organize black workers, but generally, black voters showed little interest in communist ideas. The most important change in black political thinking during the 1920s came within the traditional two-party system itself. Blacks usually had voted for Republicans since the days of Abraham Lincoln. but the conservative Republican policies of the 1920s caused many blacks to become Democrats. By 1932, blacks would vote by a large majority for the Democratic presidential candidate, Franklin Roosevelt, and blacks continue to be a major force in the Democratic Party.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.